I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Tomorrow in Baltimore and in cities throughout the United States, people will celebrate Juneteenth, also known as Emancipation Day. On Wednesday, Congress passed a bill establishing Juneteenth as a federal holiday. My guest today is the acclaimed historian and author from Harvard University, Annette Gordon Reed. Her new book is a poignant memoir of her childhood in Texas, an incisive history of that unique state, and an expansive reflection on the meaning of Juneteenth to her family and to generations of African Americans. The book is called On Juneteenth. Annette Gordon Reed joins me to talk about it today on Midday, after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. On June 19, 1865, Major General Gordon Granger issued General Order No. 3 in Galveston, Texas, declaring that all slaves were free, 2 months after General Robert E. Lee had surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant in Appomattox, Virginia, to end the Civil War. My guest today is the author and historian Annette Gordon Reed. She has written a beautiful peroration about the meaning of the holiday that marks the anniversary of that event. It is at once an homage to her home state of Texas and a wholly original and fascinating exploration of how history and legend and myth all shape what we learn when we're young and how our understanding evolves as we grow older and how social dynamics inform the evolution of societal understanding as well. Professor Gordon Reed writes with erudition and grace, authority and humility, weaving a touching personal memoir into the stark reality of a harsh historical record. The book is called On Juneteenth. Annette Gordon Reed and I spoke about it last week. Because our conversation was recorded earlier, we can't take any calls or comments. Professor Gordon Reed joined me from her home in New York. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me begin by asking you to tell us exactly what's in General Order No. 3 that General Granger announced in Galveston in June of 1865. It does say all slaves are free, but it says a whole lot more. Place General Order No. 3 in proper context for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, the order is relatively short, but as you said, it has a number of important passages along with the statement about slavery being over in Texas. Granger then goes on to say that the former enslaved people would exist in a state of absolute equality with the people who were their former enslavers. He also says that he cautions them against leaving their homes at that particular moment. He advises them to stay where they are and work for wages for the former enslavers, and that they don't come to the army. Do not expect to come to the army, because we're not going to support you in idleness, is the phrase that he uses. And that kind of raises some hackles there among some people who read that. But the important things are the statement about the end of slavery. And I also think the statement that they would exist in a state of absolute equality in terms of rights and property rights as their former enslavers, which wasn't necessary to say, and it wasn't a situation that actually obtained afterwards. I mean, we've been aspiring to that for a long time, but it's a document that obviously caught the attention of enslaved people and whites in the area as well, who responded negatively to the proclamation. They were smarting at having lost a war and certainly did not like the idea of being told that they would live in equality with people whom they had treated as property before that time period.
And it ends legalized slavery in Texas, but not legalized slavery in the country as a whole. When did that happen?
That happened at the end of December 1865 when the 13th Amendment was finally ratified. So legal slavery ends there. What happened in Texas was a result of the end of the fighting in the Civil War. Most people think that the fighting stopped when Lee surrendered at Appomattox. As you know, Lee is sort of the preeminent, the most famous of the Confederate generals, and it's almost as if he's in charge of the entire army. He was in charge of the Army of Northern Virginia, and they surrendered, but the Army of the Trans-Mississippi kept fighting, and indeed won the last battle of the Civil War, but by then, in a place near Brownsville, but by then they understood that there was really no point in going on, and at the beginning of June, the army surrendered, and at that point, Granger, who is in Louisiana, goes to Galveston and writes and announces General Order Number 3 with the information that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and that was really fascinating. You're talking about the Battle of Palmito Ranch in the middle of May, mm-hmm. and the Confederacy, or the Confederate soldiers, actually won that battle. Mm-hmm. And you make the observation that white Texans ultimately became much more obstreperous about slavery than Southerners in general because they had won the last battle. I mean, that really did inform how they sort of thought of the Civil War and how it had gone, didn't it?
And they had been a republic. They'd had an experience of almost 10 years of being the Republic of Texas. And so they had a very high opinion of themselves and, a very determined sense of independence. So it was a crushing blow to all white Southerners, but it, in particular, I think, for Texas.
Annette Gordon Reed is my guest. Her new book is called On Juneteenth. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any calls or comments today. So, Professor, the roots that your family has in Texas go way back. You mentioned your mother's side dates back to the 1820s and your father's side to the 1860s. And that there are three dominant images associated with Texas, the oil man, the cowboy, and the rancher. Talk about those images and the hierarchy of those images, and then the very important one that you add to that list, which was the slave plantation owner.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, most people know about the cowboy and the rancher and the oil man, and what comes to mind, of course, is the film Giant, which presented the conflict between them. I mean, obviously, in the movie, and I suppose in life, the cowboy and the cattleman precede the oil man. You discover oil is really a 20th century phenomenon, but cattle ranching and cowboys go back for centuries in Texas, with the precursors in Mexico and Spain. So you think of it as the beginnings of Texas. Most people think of it as part of the beginnings of Texas. And the oilmen come along and you have the image of the rich, somewhat crude sometimes, Texas oil man who competes with the cattle rancher. And they, at some point, come together when the King Ranch, that's almost 1 million acres, where Exxon, you know, got leasing rights and became Exxon in doing that on those millions of acres of land that where they struck oil. So, and this is portrayed in the film Giant. At least the ranch in that film is sort of modeled after the King Ranch. And that's what people think of when they think of Texas. And usually, I say in the book, usually Texas is constructed as a white man. You think of a macho place and cowboy, cattleman, rancher. And no thought of another very, very important part of Texas, which was East Texas, which was a plantation society. The father of Texas, Stephen F. Austin, after his father died, his father had gotten the right to get land and to bring Anglo settlers into Texas as a way of providing a bulwark against the Comanche and Apache, who were competing with Europeans over land in Texas. And these people, the people who came, brought enslaved people with them. And Austin understood from the very beginning that slavery would be incredibly important to the fortunes of the settlers and of Texas, even though he thought that he was sort of ambivalent about slavery because he didn't like the idea of large numbers of black people living with large numbers of black people, which was required in the slave society. But nevertheless, he understood that it was necessary for economic progress. So East Texas, where all of this is taking place, becomes a part of, and the intention was to become a part of the Cotton Empire of the South, which was an engine of wealth for the elite among Southerners, and was at the core of their society. So it's always been interesting to me that you think of, most people think of Texas as in the West and don't think about slavery. Slavery for most people is probably, you know, Tara. You think of Georgia and Mississippi and Louisiana and those places, but not Texas. And Texas was clearly a slave society with the bulk of the population in East Texas, not West Texas. But we have this image of the cowboy and not the image of the slave plantation owner. And I mean, part of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to give people a more capacious understanding of what Texas history has wrought. I mean, why the state is the way it is has a lot to do with the legacy of slavery and the racial hierarchy that was created in slavery.
Yeah, and you write that even after General Order Number 3, there were some that continued to hold black people in slavery under threat of violence. There were sort of riots and uprisings among Confederate soldiers who lashed out after they were defeated. So Granger, part of his job was to restore order, to keep things quiet. But there were all these, there was a big unleashing of a torrent of violence against freed black people by whites. And the cowboy image, which ultimately becomes the sort of dominant image that people associate with Texas, sort of cleans that up. I mean, it cleans up the dimension of slavery and plantation slavery in Texas. People don't think of it that way. They think of the lone cowboy out on the range. It's a way of shaping the myth and shaping the narrative that it's the most convenient of the three, the rancher, the oilman, and the cowboy. It's the most convenient to sort of erase that dimension of slavery.
It's the image that sort of instantly makes him a candidate for being reviled. I mean, the oil man now in the era of climate change, you know, some of the luster has gone off of that part of it, but it's not anything like, and the cattle rancher, I suppose, for, you know, maybe other reasons, there are people who might not like that, but a slave owner, and with all of its attendant associations, that's not an image that people want it for the state. And you emphasizing these other two people lets people off the hook in Texas. But it also makes it, some of the things that happen there, for people who don't know this history, it may make it seem strange and bizarre, when in fact it makes perfect sense what's going on.
You mentioned that of the many things that are unique about Texas, some of the important ones are, you mentioned this just a minute ago, that Texas had existed as an independent nation, an independent state. It shares a border with a foreign country. There's a long history there of disputes between Europeans and indigenous populations. And through all of this, and it had plantation-based slavery and Jim Crow laws later, you say that violence has been foregrounded in the origin story of Texas. So that's a central element to our understanding of Texas, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And even aside, but strangely enough, not necessarily the violence of slavery, but the violence, again, it's still very Western, with gunfighters and Texas Rangers and, you know, fighting and the Alamo, the notion of the Alamo, that this is the last stand, fighting to the death and so forth. And it's the violent imagery and the notion of violence as giving birth to things, as creative in a way, almost, is a part of the understanding of Texas. But we don't think about the violence of slavery because, as we have said, the institution has remained largely hidden behind the image of Western iconography and cattlemen and cowboys.
Annette Gordon-Reed. Her latest book is called On Juneteenth. We'll have more with Annette Gordon-Reed after a quick break. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take any calls or comments today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. I appreciate that. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Annette Gordon-Reed. She's the Carl M. Loeb University Professor of History on the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard Law School. She is the author of many books and the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for The Hemings of Monticello, An American Family. We're talking about her latest book, a reflection called On Juneteenth. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take any calls or comments. So, Professor Gordon-Reed, you were sent by your parents in the first grade to a white school, and this is in a town called Conroe, Texas. Tell us about the town and tell us about the school, the two school possibilities that you had and the reasons that your folks decided to send you to the white school.
Mm-hmm. Well, Conroe, a little bit about the background of Conroe. Conroe was an oil town, was founded as an oil town. It's not far from the Humble oil fields, an area where oil was discovered, and it was a prosperous town from the beginning. There was, at some point in the 20s or the 30s, I think it was listed as having more millionaires than any other, you know, similar, you know, any town in the country or something like that. So it was a prosperous place. Blacks made up maybe less than 10% of the population in Conroe, at least when I was there. And I don't get the sense that there were ever large numbers of black people there, but there were some there. And it had a reputation as a very, very hard town racially. There were lynchings in Conroe. A man was burned at the stake on the courthouse square in the 1920s. A man who had been accused of raping a white woman was killed in open court while he sat at the defendant's table, and the person who shot him, a white man, the husband of the woman who he allegedly raped, was acquitted. He did this in full view of the jury and the judge and police officers and everyone. And he was put on trial but acquitted after about 3 minutes, and everybody cheered and nothing ever happened to him. And that, those kinds of things, lynchings, that particular event shaped attitudes about the town, and obviously that kind of memory of those things happening remained with people. And so it was a town, it was a little town in the sense that, little town virtues in the sense that people normally think of, sort of casualness. I grew up, you know, running around, riding my bike, running around barefoot, doing all kinds of things that you think of, you know, hanging with my friends. But there was always, we knew there's the possibility of violence and repression, because we were an extreme minority there and black people were disfavored. When it was time for me to go to first grade, Texas was doing, not just Texas, but other jurisdictions as well, other places as well, were resisting Brown versus Board of Education, which had been decided about 10 years before this. And they were coming up with various plans to try to circumvent the Brown decision. And one of the plans they had was called a Freedom of Choice Plan. And the idea was that white people and black people would choose on the basis of the traditions of the town. White parents would choose white schools and black parents would choose black schools. And when this happened, my parents decided to do something different. They decided to send me to Anderson Elementary School, a white school. Now, I had been at Booker T. Washington School, which was a K through 12 school that served the black community in Conroe. My kindergarten, I'd spent the year there in kindergarten. My older brothers were at Washington, and indeed my mother taught English at Washington School, at Booker T. Washington School. But they decided to send me there, and their reasons for doing it, making this decision, changed over time. And this is the interesting point for me as a historian, thinking about historical witnesses and their recollections of the past. Because I recall them being much more idealistic than they made out to be later on. As they became disillusioned with integration, they said, well, we sent you there because we knew that the court was going to strike down the Freedom of Choice plan. And when that happened, you would be in place. So they made it pragmatic. My father said, well, Washington was K through 12 and white schools were divided. Elementary school, intermediate school, junior high, and high school. And he thought that sort of indicated to him that there was something about having different groups of children together, separating them from other age groups that had an educational purpose to it. He said, that's why I sent you. But I remember, I think they were idealistic in their decision. This was the middle of the 60s, there was the Civil Rights Act, 64, there was the Voting Rights Act of 65, and there was something in the air. People were doing things, people were marching. There was a sense that black people were sort of on the move. And I think, and from the way they talked at the time and the way people in my family the way they responded to all of this, that this was an idealistic move on their part, but they didn't want to admit it in a later year. So I integrated the school, Ruby Bridges very famously did this before me under, much more pressure-filled circumstances. She was escorted by federal marshals, but my father took me to Anderson and dropped me off. They had all talked about this, the school district and my parents, and I think the media would have been the town newspaper, that they weren't going to make a big deal about this, that I would just go as if this were not, nothing was out of the ordinary. But of course it was out of the ordinary because I was the only black person in the school, a black child, or no teachers either, just, the only black person in the school at this juncture. And I took my place in class. My teacher, Mrs. Daughtry, was wonderful in the way she treated me. She never made me feel that I was any different than anyone else, always very supportive. And I do recall sometimes there would be delegations of people who would come and stand in the doorway and look in and watch me. And that gave me this sense. I knew that also made me understand, sort of drove home, that what I was doing was unusual and that people thought they had to pay attention to this experiment in a way. But, you know, it was stressful in some instances. My mother said I once broke out in hives, and they kind of think that might have been stress related. Some of the kids, unlike the teachers who were all uniformly nice to me, some of the kids were nice and some were not. Some went out of their way to ask me to play, you know, with them, and others, you know, were mean.
And you mentioned that also their reaction to you was often different out of school than it was in school. When you would run into them in town, if they were with their parents or with relatives, you'd say hello to them and they wouldn't even respond.
Yeah, yeah. Or they would respond in a very guarded way. And that tipped me off even more. I mean, I understood that race, and I wouldn't have called it race. I would have said, you know, Negroes and white people, that there were problems, that there was an issue here. And I knew that because even before then, really, because I went to, when I would go to the doctor, our clinic was separated by race. There was a waiting room for black people and a waiting room for white people, a much better appointed waiting room for white people. And when we went to the movies, we sat in the balcony. Black people had to sit in the balcony. So I knew even before I went to Anderson, I mean, when I'm, you know, a five-year-old, I understand that you know, there's something different here. We're being treated differently because our skin color is different. But this kind of thing where people who I genuinely thought liked me, and I believe they did, but they also loved their parents and their families, and the choice between, they saw it as a choice between honoring their connection to me and honoring their connection to their family. And of course, you know what they're going to do. And that's what most people do. And that's why, you know, prejudice and these things continue, because, you know, my father used to say that you can have friends and they will really like you, they'll love you, and they'll want to do what's right, but they won't be able to do what is right because their family won't let them, in the sense that they faced rejection if they were too close to black people, if they violated racial norms. So this whole experience probably got me thinking a lot about race and the role of race in my life and in Texas and in the world, and maybe probably led me to also the study to become a historian of slavery.
Annette Gordon Reed is my guest. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're talking about her latest book, On Juneteenth. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we're not taking calls or comments today. And you have become a preeminent historian, one of the most preeminent historians of our time. And the nuanced approach you have to history is so very important. This was very much evident in your book about Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson and your work in that regard. But you write in this book, On Juneteenth, about the tyranny of the ideas about the archive and what constitutes the official record, and the importance of counter-narratives and how central that is to the writing of history, as well as the influence, the presence, the undeniability of myths and legends. How do you sort all of that out? What is the historian's role when it comes to the mythology and the legends what many people would consider, you know, the historical archive, and how one discerns what to pay attention to what to put in larger context?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, an integral part of being a historian. I mean, we recognize that myths serve a function in society. It's not just Americans. Very often people write as if Americans are the only people who are enthralled to myths. They seem to be something that communities, people need to bind them in bind themselves together in a society. But historians have a different task because it's not about binding people together. It's about trying to figure out as nearly as you can what happened in the past. I mean, we'll never know things with 100% accuracy, and things will change as new information comes to light. Everybody talks about revisionist history in a sort of a pejorative way, but history is always being revised as new information comes to the fore and as people ask different questions about the material. You know, someone reading, say, the Texas, you know, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas will read that document and read right over the provisions that support slavery or provisions that say that African Americans or people of African descent can't settle in Texas and can't become citizens of Texas. And they'll read that and it really doesn't register with them. It's not something that they talk about. You know, maybe 60, 70 years ago, it may not have been worth comment, but there's no way today that people trained in history who are, you know, working on the 19th century or who are specializing in this time period could look at that document and fail to note those things because they would think they're important. And who knows how people will read it 100 years from now, but we are at a moment when we are interested in questions of race. And 100 years ago, or they were in a moment when they were interested in something else. So it's always going to be a process of revising as you get new information. And as I said, as you begin to ask different questions of the material, it's the historian's job to recognize the existence of myth, but get beyond that.
My guest is the author and historian Annette Gordon Reed. We're talking about her latest book, On Juneteenth. We'll have more with Professor Gordon Reed on the other side of a quick break. A reminder, our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any calls or online comments today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the acclaimed historian and author Annette Gordon Reed. She is best known for her study of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. Her book, The Hemings of Monticello, An American Family, won 16 book prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Her latest book is a wonderful memoir and rumination on the history and significance of Juneteenth, a holiday that celebrates the day that slaves in Galveston, Texas were told they were free 2 months after the end of the Civil War. Celebrations of that event on June 19th, called Juneteenth, originated in Texas and now take place around the country. Juneteenth is not yet a national holiday, but Annette Gordon Reed thinks the prospects of it becoming a national holiday are good. The book is called simply On Juneteenth. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any calls or online comments today. So, Professor Gordon Reed, tell us about your affection for the song Galveston.
Mm-hmm. Well, I loved it from the first time I heard it as a kid, when it was out as a hit. The guitar, the words, the sentiments in the words, Glen Campbell singing is so heartfelt. So all of it is so heartfelt. And, you know, created an image in my mind about this young man who's thinking about this young girl at Galveston. When I got a little bit older, my mother told me that my great-grandfather, who had a cotton farm with my great-grandmother in Moscow, Texas. It's spelled Moscow. You would see that, you would think it's Moscow, but it's right out, a little bit outside of Moscow, Texas, as they say. Had a cotton farm there, and he used to leave the farm and go down to Galveston to work on the wharves. And he could make enough money that he could, you know, hire a couple of people to help my grandmother on the farm, because they had daughters. Their son had died. And still sort of, come out better because he was able to make money on the wharf. So Galveston has this sort of place in my family that I hadn't known about before, and not a settled place, because he was only there, you know, he was only there periodically during the year. And ever since I heard that story, it made me, Galveston think makes me think about my great-grandparents. The roles are reversed. The man has gone off and the woman is still at home, but it made me think of this, and that's what, you know, great songs and great art does. You're able to take the sentiments and the thoughts or the emotions that they evoke and bring them to bear on situations in your life that may even be different than what the actual song is talking about. So now I think of it not just as a beautiful song, but I think of it in terms of my great-grandparents, who are very far different from a young man in Vietnam thinking about his girl in Galveston, who's two African-American people on a small farm in Texas.
And at the end of the book, you ask the question, what is it that I love about the state of Texas? Because your affection for Texas comes through every page of this book. But you also take a very unstinting look at its history, the history of slavery, the history of its treatment of Native Americans, the history of Native Americans' treatment of African Americans. And it's, as I said at the very top of the show, a harsh history. And on so many levels. But ultimately, your affection, it's authentic and it's deep. Why ultimately do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because I associate Texas with my family and my mother and my father and my brothers and my grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And our community, the experiences that I had there that made me the person who I am, and memories of good things that happen that are connected to the land where they happened. Texas, I have a vision of Texas, a version of Texas that grows out of the experiences that I have there. And I don't think that the experiences of other people, people who may deny my connection to the place, people who were not nice to me when I was there, those things don't define it for me. You know, they have their Texas and I have mine. As you mentioned, members of my family have been in Texas since before it was Texas and all throughout. And right now, I would say for most of my life, most of my family has been in Texas, and we're not a family that participated in the Great Migration. The Great Migration in my family was to Houston. It was not or Dallas. It wasn't to New York or Chicago or California. In the main, we're all there, and there's just too much of me and my family there for me not to feel affection for the place, and feel that these connections, I will always have these kinds of connections. I don't live there. I married a Californian and who I dragged to New York, supposed to be for a couple of years, and we've been here since then. And, you know, but Texas, I could easily live in Texas if I had, you know, the opportunity to do that, because it's a part of me. And so I don't think, what I'm saying is that I don't think that the problems of Texas or how other people are responding to me define for me what I think about this place, given the things that happened to me there.
And your celebrations of Juneteenth with your family and the dimensions of it, the menu items that your grandparents added to the initial menu items are a big part of your memories of growing up and your origin story. Tell us how you used to celebrate Juneteenth, and do you celebrate it in any similar way now?
Well, when I was a kid, and the most poignant and the sharpest memories of Juneteenth celebrations for me are as a kid running around with my friends and cousins, usually at my grandmother's house, but sometimes at our home. My grandparents lived in Livingston, where I was born, and about 50 miles northeast of Conroe. And running around with my friends, members of the community, drinking too much red soda water, which is sort of a staple of Juneteenth. You're supposed to have some sort of red drink. I'm told that hibiscus tea may have been the first red drink that people had, because obviously they didn't have soda pop in the 19th century. And barbecue, goat is associated with it. Our family didn't eat goat. I recall once a goat being killed to be prepared for this. I watched that once and vowed never to watch it again.
And that was enough, yeah.
That once is enough for me. And traditional Southern fare, but my grandmother got a recipe from my mother, who got a recipe from another woman, about making hot tamales. We call them hot tamales, but they would be just tamales. And they were hot because sometimes she would make them really hot for people who requested it. And she, as a housewife, she sold tamales to raise money for the St. Luke's United Methodist Church to build a new church. So she would take orders on holidays for tamales, and Juneteenth was a day, was a good business, because people would pre-order tamales. And I talk in the book about the many hours I sat with my mother and grandmother and great aunt and made hot tamales in when I didn't want to be. And it's like, I was a kid, I wanted to be out doing things. I didn't really appreciate what those moments were like. And I would love to be able to have those back, obviously. But that became a part of it. And it just sort of shows you the specialness of Texas, in the sense that, we don't talk about the state becoming diverse. It was diverse from the beginning. It started out with differing people meeting together, obviously in different positions, but all together in this one place. Anglos, Indians, people of African descent, Latinos, always there. And that multiculturalism has been there from the beginning, and we have been grappling with that from the very beginning. But it started that way. And the celebration of this holiday ending slavery with cuisine from all of the different groups is sort of symbolic of that.
Annette Gordon-Reed, the book is called On Juneteenth. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking calls and comments. And these stories, these memories, are part of your own personal origin story. And you talk about origin stories and their importance in history. And you say it's not about, it's about our current needs and desires. It's not actually about history. And you contrast the stories of Plymouth and the Pilgrims and Jamestown and the first, what were thought to be the first slaves who were brought from Africa. And you observe that the story is actually much richer than the arrival of slaves to Jamestown in 1619. And you talk about a figure called Estebanico. Mm-hmm. So talk about why origin stories are more about where we are currently than they are about our understanding necessarily of history.
Well, because we're looking to find out, to find something, central, some sort of central part of our identity. We look to origin stories to tell us who we are now. And history is not well, doing history is not about who we are now. History is about change over time, and it's about looking back at points in the past to try as nearly as you possibly can to come to some understanding about those moments. Now, that may be necessary for how we think about ourselves, but origin stories very often become, I mean, you know, you're not going to be satisfied if the origin isn't a pleasant one. Do you know what I mean? That there's there's defensiveness about a story of origin stories that make you feel guilty or make you feel bad about people with whom you feel some sort of connection. Historians, you know, typically if you're doing it right, you're not supposed to have a stake in what you find in the archive. I mean, so that it warps the way you view things. You know, you're not interested in telling a comforting story. Because you know, as a historian, the past is not, nor is the present, always comforting. But origin stories, I think, are more towards mythology. It's more towards the affective, for some sort of affective reassurance about who you are, who we are. And I think that's why it's important to try to keep things straight and to make sure that people don't stray too far from the historical record as they are constructing these. Yeah, I mean, the story of African Americans is much in the Americas is much richer than just Jamestown. Jamestown's important, obviously, but Estevanico is in the area that's called Texas, in almost 100 years before, over 100 years before African peoples are in Jamestown. St. Augustine, which is not in Texas, but it's linked to the Spanish, that too was up and running well before Jamestown. And even in the area that's called Texas, there were other people of African descent whose names we don't know, who came with the Spanish. And some of them were enslaved, some of them were not. Some of them went off on their own into Central America, into Mexico, Central America. There's the genetic heritage of that flows from that. And we need to know those people as well. I say in the book, it doesn't make any sense to me for African Americans to think that we have things in common only with Black people who speak English. I mean, the people who were brought to the Americas, whether by the Spanish or the British or the French, they spoke different languages, but they had something in common. They were brought to be enslaved in the Americas, and they lived under the doctrine of white supremacy. They would have been treated the same, you know, pretty much the same as enslaved people, whatever colony they landed in. So it makes no sense for African Americans to sort of accept the boundaries of the people who captured them or held them in bondage, instead of thinking of the ties that exist between and among enslaved people, existed between all of these people in these various colonies.
Annette Gordon Reed, the book is called On Juneteenth, and there's plenty more to talk about in this wonderful book, but we are out of time. Thank you so much. I just so very much enjoyed reading this book, and I think it's really important and insightful, and I really had a great time talking to you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's it for us today. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Mallory Pinkard-Pierre is our supervising producer. Rob Sivak is our senior producer. Jamila Kremple is our digital content director. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. The book we've been speaking of is called On Juneteenth. The author is Annette Gordon Reed. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.